And good afternoon, Braidwood. It's Rod McClure finally back to finish off Ivanhoe. Probably the longest wait in the history of on-air book readings. I do apologise. Unfortunately, I went away for a week, which I did presage, but I couldn't have foreseen what was going to happen the following week. And I was looking after my son, who had a knee reconstruction for 2 weeks as well. So unfortunately, it's been a long, long wait. But we will finish Ivanhoe today, and then we'll get on to something about as different as you can get. I will go back a little bit with Ivanhoe to the penultimate fight between Bois Guilbert and Ivanhoe to just recap. But for now, a word from our sponsors.
Long-term Braidwood FM sponsor, Hockey's Braidwood, have a tilt tray that has a capability to carry 20-foot shipping containers and anything around 12.5 tonne. Hockey's can also supply you with bulk water deliveries, gravel, and they have a Kanga Mini for hire. You can phone the office on 4842 2286 or Stephen Hockey on 0429 422 286.
Capital Chemist Braidwood is open Monday to Friday 8am till 5pm and Saturday 8am to 12:30pm at their new larger premises at the Village Terrace. The friendly professional staff can assist you with medication packing to assist with managing your medication, having your scripts kept on file with the pharmacy, acquiring MedAdvisor, an online app to help order and manage your scripts that are on file, COVID-19 vaccinations. Capital Chemist Braidwood, proudly sponsoring Braidwood FM 88.9.
Ever thought of becoming a Freemason? Freemasonry is made up of men from all walks of life, serving their community while engaged in self-improvement, building friendships and seeking excellence in all pursuits. Lodge of Truth Braidwood has been in our community for over 160 years and we invite you to become a member of Braidwood's longest serving fraternity. If this interests you, please call Phil Schumark on 0427 422 046 for more information about membership. Sponsoring Braidwood FM 88.9.
Holdfast Distillery is Braidwood's first distillery, located in the basement of Braidwood Hotel at 180 Wallace Street. Their products are made with Australian grain and are distilled in their specially designed still to produce clean and crisp products. They select the best botanicals grown in Australia or source from overseas, ensuring there is no compromise in their products. Call 0406 083 963 for opening hours. Holdfast Distillery, a sponsor of Braidwood FM 88.9.
And as always, a big thank you to our sponsors. Well, back to Ivanhoe and the big moment. The trumpets sounded and the knights charged each other in full career. The wearied horse of Ivanhoe and its no less exhausted rider went down, as all had expected, before the well-aimed lance and the vigorous steed of the Templar. This issue of the combat all had foreseen, but although the spear of Ivanhoe did but in comparison touch the shield of Bois Guilbert, that champion, to the astonishment of all who beheld it, reeled in his saddle, lost his stirrups, and fell in the lists. Ivanhoe, extracting himself from his fallen horse, was soon on foot, hastening to mend his fortune with his sword, but his antagonist rose not. Wilfred, placing his foot on his breast and the sword's point to his throat, commanded him to yield or die on the spot. Bois Guilbert returned no answer. "Slay him not, Sir Knight," cried the Grand Master. "Unshriven and unabsolved, kill not body and soul. We allow him vanquished." He descended into the lists and commanded them to unhelm the conquered champion. His eyes were closed. The dark red flush was still on his brow. As they looked on him in astonishment, the eyes opened, but they were fixed and glazed. The flush passed from his brow and gave way to the pallid hue of death. Unscathed by the lance of his enemy, he had died a victim to the violence of his own contending passions. "This is indeed the judgment of God," said the Grand Master, looking upwards. "Fiat voluntas tua." Chapter 44. When the first moments of surprise were over, Wilfred of Ivanhoe demanded of the Grand Master, as judge of the field, if he had manfully and rightfully done his duty in the combat.
"Manfully and rightfully hath it been done," said the Grand Master. I pronounce the maiden free and guiltless. The arms and the body of the deceased knight are at the will of the victor."
"I will not despoil him of his weapons," said the knight of Ivanhoe, "nor condemn his corpse to shame.
He has fought for Christendom. God's arm, no human hand, has this day struck him down. But let his obsequies be private, as becomes those of a man who died in an unjust quarrel. And for the maiden..." He was interrupted by a clattering of horses' feet, advancing in such numbers and so rapidly as to shake the ground before them. And the Black Knight galloped into the lists. He was followed by numerous men-at-arms and several knights, all in complete armour. "I am too late," he said, looking around him. "I had doomed Bois Guilbert for my own property. Ivanhoe, was this well to take you on such a venture? You are scarce able to keep the saddle." "Oh, heaven, my liege," answered Ivanhoe, "has taken this proud man for its victim. He was not to be honoured in dying as your will had designed." "Peace be with him," said Richard, looking steadfastly on the corpse. "If it may be so, he was a gallant knight and has died in his steel harness full knightly, but we must waste no time. Bowen, do your office." A knight stepped forward from the king's attendants, and laying his hand on the shoulder of Albert de Mauvoisin, said, "I arrest you for high treason." The Grand Master had hitherto stood astonished at the appearance of so many warriors. He now spoke.
Who dares to arrest a knight of the Temple of Zion, within the girth of his own preceptory, and in the presence of the Grand Master, and by whose authority is this bold outrage offered?"
"I make the arrest," replied the knight. "I, Henry Bohun, Earl of Essex, Lord High Constable of England." "And he arrests Malvoisin," said the king, raising his visor, "by the order of Richard Plantagenet, here present. Conrad Montfichet, it is well for you that you are born no subject of mine, but for you, Malvoisin, you die with your brother Philip ere the week is a week older." "I will resist thy doom," said the Grand Master. "Proud Templar," said the king, "you cannot. Look up and behold the royal standard of England floats over your towers instead of your temple banner. Be wise, Beaumanoir, and make no bootless opposition. Your hand is in the lion's mouth."
"I will appeal to Rome against you," said the Grand Master, "for usurpation on the immunities and the privileges of our order."
"Oh, be it so," said the king, "but for your own sake, tax me not with usurpation now. Dissolve your chapter and depart with your followers to the next preceptory, if you can find one, which has not been made the scene of treasonable conspiracy against the King of England, or if you will, remain to share our hospitality and behold our justice."
"To be a guest in a house where I should command?" said the Templar. "Never. Chaplains, raise the psalm, Quare femurunt gente. Knights, squires, and followers of the Holy Temple, prepare to follow the banner, Beau Seant." The Grand Master spoke with a dignity which confronted that of even England's king himself, and inspired outrage and courage into his surprised and dismayed followers. They gathered together around him like the sheep around the watchdog when they hear the baying of the wolf. But they evinced not the timidity of the scared flock. There were dark brows of defiance and looks which menaced the hostility they dared not proffer in words. They drew together in a dark line of spears from which the white cloaks of the knights were visible among the dusky garments of their retainers, like the lighter-coloured edges of a sable cloud. The multitude, who had raised a clamorous shout of reprobation, paused and gazed in silence on the formidable and experienced body to which they had unwarily bade defiance, and they shrank back from their front. The Earl of Essex, when he beheld them pause in their assembled force, dashed the rails into his charger's sides and galloped backwards and forwards to array his followers in opposition to a band so formidable. Richard alone, as if he loved the danger his presence had provoked, rode slowly along the front of the Templars, calling aloud, "What, sirs? Among so many gallant knights, will none dare to splinter a spear with Richard? Sirs of the Temple, your ladies are but sunburned if they are not worth the shiver of a broken lance."
"The brethren of the Temple," said the Grand Master, riding forward in advance of their body, "fight not on such idle and profane quarrel, and not with you, Richard of England. Shall a Templar cross lance in my presence? The Pope and the princes of Europe shall judge our quarrel, and whether a Christian prince has done well in bucklering the cause which you have today adopted. If unassailed, we depart assailing no one. To your honour we refer the armour and household goods of the order which we leave behind us, and on your conscience we lay the scandal and offence you have this day given to Christendom." And with these words, and without waiting a reply, The Grand Master gave the signal of departure. Their trumpets sounded a wild march of an oriental character, which formed the usual signal for the Templars to advance. They changed their array, formed a line to column of march, and moved off as slowly as their horses could step, as if to show it was only the will of their Grand Master and no fear of the opposing and superior force which was compelling them to withdraw. "By the splendour of Our Lady's brow," said King Richard, "it is a pity of their lives that these Templars are not so trusty as they are disciplined and valiant." The multitude, like a timid cur, which waits to bark till the object of its challenge has turned his back, raised a feeble shout as the rear of the squadron left the ground. During the tumult which attended the retreat of the Templars, Rebecca saw and heard nothing. She was locked in the arms of her aged father, giddy and almost senseless with the rapid change of circumstances around her. But one word from Isaac at length recalled her scattered feelings. "Let us go," he said, "my dear daughter, my recovered treasure. Let us go, throw ourselves at the feet of the good youth." "No, not so," said Rebecca. "Oh, no, no, no. I must not at this moment dare to speak to him. Alas, I should say more. No, my father, let us instantly leave this evil place." "But my daughter," said Isaac, "to leave him who has come forth like a strong man, with his spear and shield, holding his life as nothing, so he might redeem your captivity, and you too, the daughter of a people strange unto him and his... This is service to be thankfully acknowledged." It is, most thankfully, most devoutly acknowledged," said Rebecca. "It shall be still more so, but not now. For the sake of your beloved Rachel, father, grant my request, not now." "Nay, but," said Isaac, insisting, "they will deem us more thankless than mere dogs." "But you see us, dear father, that King Richard is in presence, and that..." "True, my best, my wisest Rebecca. Let us hence. Money he will lack, for he has just returned from Palestine, and as they say, from prison. A pretext for exacting it, should he need any, may rise out of my simple traffic with his brother John. Away, away, let us go." And hurrying his daughter in his turn, he conducted her from the lists, and by means of conveyance which he had provided, transported her safely to the house of Rabbi Nathan. The Jewess, whose fortunes had formed the principal interest of the day, having now retired unobserved, the attention of the populace was transferred to the Black Knight. They now filled the air with, "Long life to Richard with the lion's heart, and down with the usurping Templars!" "Notwithstanding all this lip royalty," said Ivanhoe to the Earl of Essex, "it is well the King took the precaution to bring you with him, noble Earl, and so many of your trusty followers." The Earl smiled and shook his head. "Gallant Ivanhoe," said Essex, "do you know our master so well, and yet suspect him of taking so wise a precaution? I was drawing towards York, having heard that Prince John was making head there, when I met King Richard like a true knight-errant, galloping here, to achieve in his own person this adventure of the Templar and the Jewess with his own single arm. I accompanied him with my band, almost minus his consent." And what news from York, brave Earl?" said Ivanhoe. "Will the rebels bide us there?" "No more than a December's snow will bide July's sun," said the Earl. "They are dispersing, and who should come posting to bring us the news but John himself?" "The traitor! The ungrateful, insolent traitor," said Ivanhoe. "Did not Richard order him into confinement?" "Oh, he received him," answered the Earl, "as if they had met after a hunting party, and pointing to me and our men-at-arms said, 'You see, brother, I have some angry men with me. You had best go to our mother, carry her my duteous affection, and abide with her until men's minds are pacified.'" "And this was all he said?" inquired Ivanhoe. "Would not any one say that this prince invites men to treason by his clemency?" "Just," replied the Earl, "as the man may be said to invite death, who undertakes to fight a combat, having a dangerous wound unhealed." "I forgive you the jest, Lord Earl," said Ivanhoe, "but remember, I hazarded but my own life. Richard hazarded the welfare of his kingdom." "Those," replied Essex, "who are specially careless of their own welfare, are seldom remarkably attentive to that of others. But let us haste to the castle, for Richard meditates punishing some of the subordinate members of the conspiracy, though he has pardoned their principal." From the judicial investigations which followed on this occasion, and which are given at length in the Wardmore manuscript, it appears that Maurice de Bracy escaped beyond seas and went into the service of Philip of France, while Philip de Malvoisin and his brother Albert, the preceptor of Templestowe, were executed, although Waldemar Fitzurse, the soul of the conspiracy, escaped with banishment, and Prince John, for whose behoof it was undertaken, was not even censured by his good-natured brother. No one, however, pitied the fate of the two Malvoisins, who only suffered the death which they had both well deserved, by many acts of falsehood, cruelty, and oppression. Briefly after the judicial combat, Cedric the Saxon was summoned to the court of Richard, which, for the purpose of quieting the counties that had been disturbed by the ambition of his brother, was then held at York. Cedric touched and chawed more than once at the message, but he refused not obedience. In fact, the return of Richard had quenched every hope that he had entertained of restoring a Saxon dynasty in England, for whatever head the Saxons might have made in the event of a civil war, it was plain that nothing could be done under the undisputed dominion of Richard, popular as he was by his personal good qualities and military fame, although his administration was wilfully careless, now too indulgent and now too allied to despotism. But moreover, it could not escape even Cedric's reluctant observation that his project for an absolute union among the Saxons by the marriage of Rowena and Athelstan was now completely at an end by the mutual dissent of both parties concerned. This was indeed an event which, in his ardour for the Saxon cause, he could not have anticipated, and even when the disinclination of both was broadly and plainly manifested, he could scarce bring himself to believe that two Saxons of royal descent should scruple on personal grounds at an alliance so necessary for the public will of the nation. But it was not the less certain. Rowena had always expressed her repugnance to Athelstan, and now Athelstan was no less plain and positive in proclaiming his resolution never to pursue his addresses to the Lady Rowena. Even the natural obstinacy of Cedric sank beneath these obstacles, where he, remaining on the point of junction, had the task of dragging a reluctant pair up to it, one with each hand. He made, however, a last vigorous attack on Athelstan, and he found that resuscitated sprout of Saxon royalty engaged, like the country squires of our own day, in a furious war with the clergy. It seems that, after all his deadly menaces against the Abbot of St. Edmund's, Athelstan's spirit of revenge, what between the natural indolent kindness of his own disposition, what through the prayers of his mother Edith attached, like most ladies of the period, to the clerical order, had terminated in his keeping the abbot and his monks in the dungeons of Königsberg for 3 days on a very meagre diet. For this atrocity, the abbot menaced him with excommunication, and made out a dreadful list of complaints in the bowels and stomach, suffered by himself and his monks in consequence of the tyrannical and unjust imprisonment they had sustained. With this controversy and with the means he had adopted to counteract this clerical persecution, Cedric found the mind of his friend Athelstan so fully occupied that he had no room for another idea. And when Rowena's name was mentioned, the noble Athelstan prayed leave to quaff a full goblet to her health and that she might soon be the bride of his kinsman Wilfred. It was a desperate case, therefore. There was obviously no more to be made of Athelstan, or, as Womber expressed it in a phrase which has descended from Saxon times to ours, he was a cock that would not fight. There remained between Cedric and the determination which the lovers desired to come to only two obstacles, his own obstinacy and his dislike of the Norman dynasty. The former feeling gradually gave way before the endearments of his ward and the pride which he could not help nourishing in the fame of his son. Besides, he was not insensible to the honour of allying his own line to that of Alfred, when the superior claims of the descendants of Edward the Confessor were abandoned forever. Cedric's aversion to the Norman race of kings was also much undermined, first, by consideration of the impossibility of ridding England of the new dynasty, a feeling which goes far to create loyalty in the subject to the king de facto, and secondly by the personal attention of King Richard, who delighted in the blunt humour of Cedric, and to use the language of the Wardour manuscript, so dealt with the noble Saxon that ere he had been a guest at court for 7 days, he had given his consent to the marriage of his ward Rowena and his son Wilfred of Ivanhoe. The nuptials of our hero, thus formally approved by his father, were celebrated in the most august of temples, the noble minster of York. The king himself attended, and from countenances which he afforded on this and other occasions to the distressed and hitherto degraded Saxons, gave them a safer and more certain prospect of attaining their just rights than they could reasonably hope from the precarious chance of a civil war. The Church gave her full solemnities, graced with all the splendour which she of Rome knows how to apply with such brilliant effect. Garth, gallantly apparelled, attended, as esquire, upon his young master, whom he had served so faithfully, and the magnanimous Womba, decorated with a new cap and a most gorgeous set of silver bells. Sharers of Wilfred's dangers and adversity, they remained, as they had a right to expect, the partakers of his more prosperous career. But besides this domestic retinue, these distinguished nuptials were celebrated by the attendance of the high-born Normans as well as Saxons, joined with the universal jubilee of the lower orders that marked the marriage of two individuals as a pledge of the future peace and harmony between two races, which since that period have been so completely mingled that the distinction has become wholly invisible. Cedric lived to see this union approximate towards its completion, for as the two nations mixed in society and formed into marriages with each other, the Normans abated their scorn and the Saxons were refined from their rusticity. But it was not until the reign of Edward III that the mixed language, now termed English, was spoken at the court of London, and that the hostile distinction of Normans and Saxons seems entirely to have disappeared. It was upon the second morning after this happy bridal that the Lady Rowena was made acquainted by her handmaid, Elgitha, that a damsel desired admission to her presence and solicited that their parley might be without witnesses. Rowena wondered, hesitated, became curious, and ended by commanding the damsel to be admitted and her attendants to withdraw. She entered, a noble and commanding figure, the long white veil in which she was shrouded, overshadowing rather than concealing the elegance and majesty of her shape. Her demeanour was that of respect, unmingled with the least shade either of fear or of a wish to propitiate favour. Rowena was ever ready to acknowledge the claims and attend to the feelings of others. She arose and would have conducted her lovely visitor to a seat, but the stranger looked at Elgitha and again intimated a wish to discourse with the Lady Rowena alone. Elgitha had no sooner retired, with unwilling steps, than to the surprise of the Lady of Ivanhoe, her fair visitant kneeled on one knee, pressed her hands to her forehead, and bending her head to the ground in spite of Rowena's resistance, kissed the embroidered hem of her tunic. "What means this, lady?" said the surprised bride. "Or why do you offer me a deference so unusual?" "Because to you, Lady of Ivanhoe," said Rebecca, rising up and resuming the usual quiet dignity of her manner, "I may lawfully and without rebuke pay the debt of gratitude which I owe to Wilfred of Ivanhoe. I am, forgive the boldness which has offered to you the homage of my country. I am the unhappy Jewess for whom your husband hazarded his life against such fearful odds in the tiltyard of Templestowe." "Damsel," said Rowena, "Wilfred of Ivanhoe on that day rendered back but in slight measure your unceasing charity towards him in his wounds and in his misfortunes. Speak, is there might anything that remains which he or I can do to serve you?" "Nothing," said Rebecca calmly, "unless you will transmit to him my grateful farewell." You leave England then?" said Rowena, scarcely recovering the surprise of this extraordinary visit. "I leave it, lady, ere this moon again changes. My father has a brother high in favour with Muhammad Boabdil, King of Granada. There we go, secure of peace and protection, for the payment of such a ransom as the Muslim exact from our people." "And you are not then as well protected in England?" said Rowena. "My husband has favour with the king. The king himself is just and generous." "Lady," said Rebecca, "I doubt it not, but the people of England are a fierce race, quarrelling ever with their neighbours, or among themselves, and ready to plunge the sword into the bowels of each other. Such is no safe abode for the children of my people. Ephraim is a heartless dove, Issachar an overlaboured drudge, which stoops between two burdens. Not in a land of war and blood, surrounded by hostile neighbours and distracted by internal factions, can Israel hope to rest during her wanderings." "But you, maiden," said Rowena, "you surely can have nothing to fear. She who nursed the sickbed of Ivanhoe," she continued, rising with enthusiasm, "she can have nothing to fear in England, where Saxon and Norman will contend who shall do her honour." "Your speech is fair, lady," said Rebecca, "and your purpose fairer. but it may not be. There is a gulf between us. Our breeding, our faith, alike forbid either to pass over it. Farewell, yet before I go, indulge me one request. The bridal veil hangs over your face. Deign to raise it, and let me see the features of which fame speaks so highly. They are scarce worthy of being looked upon, said Rowena. But expecting the same from my visitant, I removed the veil. She took it off accordingly, and partly from the consciousness of beauty, partly from bashfulness, she blushed so intensely that cheek, brow, neck and bosom were suffused with crimson. Rebecca blushed also, but it was a momentary feeling, and mastered by higher emotions, passed slowly from her features, like the crimson cloud which changes colour when the sun sinks beneath the horizon. Lady, she said, the countenance you have deigned to show me will long dwell in my remembrance. There reigns in it gentleness and goodness, and if a tinge of the world's pride or vanities may mix with an expression so lovely, how should we chide that which is of earth for bearing some colour of its original? Long, long will I remember your features, and bless God that I leave my noble deliverer united with... She stopped short. Her eyes filled with tears. She hastily wiped them and answered to the anxious inquiries of Rowena. I am well, lady, well. But my heart swells when I think of Torquilston and the lists of Templestowe. Farewell. One, the most trifling part of my duty remains undischarged. Accept this casket and startle not at its contents. Rowena opened the small silver-chased casket and perceived a carcanet or necklace with ear jewels of diamonds, which were obviously of immense value. It is impossible, she said, tendering back the casket. I dare not accept a gift of such consequence. Yet keep it, lady, returned Rebecca. You have power, rank, command, influence. We have wealth, the source both of our strength and our weakness. The value of these toys 10 times multiplied would not influence half so much as your slightest wish. To you, therefore, the gift of, well, it's of little value, and to me, what I part with is much less. Let me not think you deem so wretchedly ill of my nation as your commons believe. Think you that I prize these sparkling fragments of stone above my liberty, or that my father values them in comparison to the honour of his child? Accept them, lady. To me they are valueless. I will never wear jewels more. You are then unhappy, said Rowena, struck with the manner in which Rebecca uttered these last words. Oh, remain with us. The council of holy men will wean from you erring law, and I will be a sister to you. No, lady, answered Rebecca, the same calm melancholy reigning in her soft voice and beautiful features. That may not be. I may not change the faith of my fathers like a garment unsuited to the climate in which I seek to dwell, and unhappy, lady, I will not be. He to whom I dedicate my future life will be my comforter if I do his will. Have you then convents, to one of which you mean to retire? Asked Rowena. Oh, no, lady, said the Jewess. But among our people, since the time of Abraham downwards, there have been women who have devoted their thoughts to heaven and their actions to works of kindness to men, tending the sick, feeding the hungry, relieving the distressed. Among these will Rebecca be numbered. Say this to your lord, should he chance to inquire after the fate of her whose life he saved. There was an involuntary tremor on Rebecca's voice, and a tenderness of accent which perhaps betrayed more than she would willingly have expressed. She hastened to bid Rowena adieu. Farewell, she said. May he who made both Jew and Christian shower down on you his choicest blessings. The bark that wafts us hence will be under way ere we can reach the port. She glided from the apartment, leaving Rowena surprised, as if a vision had passed before her. The fair Saxon related the singular conference to her husband, on whose mind it made a deep impression. He lived long and happily with Rowena, for they were attached to each other by the bonds of early affection, and they loved each other the more from the recollection of the obstacles which had impeded their union. Yet it would be inquiring too curiously to ask whether the recollection of Rebecca's beauty and magnanimity did not recur to his mind more frequently than the fair descendant of Alfred might altogether have approved. Ivanhoe distinguished himself in the service of Richard, and he graced with further marks the royal flavour. He might have risen still higher, but for the premature death of the heroic Coeur de Lion before the castle of Chalus near Limoges, with the life of a generous but rash and romantic monarch, perished all the projects which his ambition and his generosity had formed. to whom may be applied, with a slight alteration, the lines composed by Johnson for Charles of Sweden. His fate was destined to a foreign strand, a petty fortress and a humble hand. He left the name at which the world grew pale, to point a moral and to adorn a tale. And that is the end of Ivanhoe, and I think you would find, and probably agree, how different it actually is to the very, very popular movie that was made with Robert Taylor. The final scene where Bois Guilbert literally dies because he can't reconcile his love for Rebecca with the order of his temple to fight, and his own pride. An interesting story, and very interesting the way in which, writing as he did in the early part of the 19th century, Scott is at pains to try and bring together to find unity in England. Well, as I said, we're going to be moving on to something completely different. H.P. Lovecraft is regarded by many as the father of modern horror fiction. He was born in 1890, and his childhood was not a happy one. When he was about 3 or so, his father ended up in a psychiatric asylum. And on top of that, he was not a regular attender at school. In actual fact, he had very, very poor health. However, he did read voraciously. When his grandfather died, the family was plunged into absolute poverty. And as a young adult, even though he had a high school diploma, Lovecraft became a bit of an isolate, and he began to write. He was mostly a short story writer, although some of his longer novellas are quite good, but his influence is enormous. And it is fair to say that writers such as Stephen King, Clive Barker, Neil Gaiman, China Miéville, they all owe something to his influence on the genre. And on top of that, the extremely popular role-playing game Cthulhu is based very much upon his cycle of stories. He was not able to turn his capacity to write into wealth. He wrote mostly for things such as weird tales, pulp fiction, penny dreadfuls of the 1920s and 30s and so on. And he made a living, but it was not much of a living. His fame came in the 50s and 60s. Many of his stories have been turned into movies or teledramas, and he's left a legacy which he didn't live to see. We'll be reading two of his stories. One is called The Shadow Over Innsmouth, and the other one is The Thing on the Doorstep. They're part of the Cthulhu cycle. Remember, these were written at a time when science was just beginning to explore the boundaries of what was possible. And that's what made Lovecraft, I think, so very interesting, because he was able to meld together these ideas of horror and old beliefs and superstitions with a scientific bent that at times is way ahead of its time. He couldn't describe as we would describe today things like, you know, mind transference, for example, which is in one of his stories. Yet he wrote about it, and he made it integral, and he made it work. So I hope you enjoy these stories by H.P. Lovecraft. We've got a few minutes left, and we'll just get a little taste by beginning the first one. And it's called The Shadow Over Innsmouth. During the winter of 1927-28, officials of the federal government made a strange and secret investigation of certain conditions in the ancient Massachusetts seaport of Innsmouth. The public first learned of it in February, when a vast series of raids and arrests occurred, followed by the deliberate burning and dynamiting, under suitable precautions, of an enormous number of crumbling, worm-eaten and supposedly empty houses along the abandoned waterfront. Uninquiring souls let this occurrence pass as one of the major clashes in a spasmodic war on liquor. Keener news followers, however, wondered at the prodigious number of arrests, the abnormally large force of men used in making them, and the secrecy surrounding the disposal of the prisoners. No trials or even definite charges were reported, nor were any of the captives seen thereafter in the regular jails of the nation. There were vague statements about disease and concentration camps, and later about dispersal in various naval and military prisons, but nothing positive ever developed. Innsmouth itself was left almost depopulated and is even now only beginning to show signs of a sluggish revived existence. Complaints from many liberal organisations were met with long confidential discussions, and representatives were taken on trips to certain camps and prisons. As a result, these societies became surprisingly passive and reticent. Newspaper men were harder to manage, but seemed largely to cooperate with the government in the end. Only one paper, a tabloid, always discounted because of its wild policy, mentioned the deep-diving submarine that discharged torpedoes downward in the marine abyss just beyond Devil Reef. That item, gathered by chance in a haunt of sailors, seemed indeed rather far-fetched, since the low black reef lies a full mile and a half out from Innsmouth Harbour. People around the country and in the nearby towns muttered a great deal among themselves, but said very little to the outer world. They had talked about dying and half-deserted Innsmouth for nearly a century, and nothing new could be wilder or more hideous than what they had whispered and hinted years before. Many things had taught them secretiveness, and there was now no need to exert pressure on them. Besides, they really knew very little, for wide salt marshes, desolate and unpeopled, keep neighbours off from Innsmouth on the landward side. But at last I'm going to defy a ban on speech about this thing. Results, I am certain, are so thorough that no public harm, save a shock of repulsion, could ever accrue from a hinting of what was found by those horrified raiders at Innsmouth. Besides, what was found might possibly have more than one explanation. I do not know just how much of the whole tale has been told, even to me, and I have many reasons for not wishing to probe deeper. For my contact with this affair has been closer than that of any other layman, and I have carried away impressions which are yet to drive me to drastic measures. It was I who fled frantically out of Innsmouth in the early morning hours of July 16th, 1927, and whose frightened appeals for government inquiry and action brought on the whole reported episode. I was willing enough to stay mute while the affair was fresh and uncertain, but now that it is an old story, with public interest and curiosity gone, I have an odd craving to whisper about those few frightful hours in that ill-rumoured and evilly shadowed seaport of death and blasphemous abnormality. The mere telling helps me to restore confidence in my own faculties, to reassure myself that I was not simply the first to succumb to a contagious nightmare hallucination. It helps me, too, in making up my mind regarding a certain terrible step which lies ahead of me. And I hope that you will enjoy our new author, Lovecraft. I'll be back next week with another book reading. Until then, take care.